evening. I wish I had left a little sooner. It turned out I drove through sheets and sheets of rain to get here, and those sheets are now headed your way. So expect a good wet night. I want to explain my view of an old Earth before I begin. Typically, I've given this talk, I believe, 2 times before at every seminars like this, and I always feel kind of crunched for time at the end, because we're going to have dessert first tonight and then the main course. So this may not follow the order of your notes exactly, and indeed, I'm not sure there's anything in your notes that pertains to what I'm about to say. So if you'll just bear with me while I give you a little philosophy, then I'll jump into the paleobotany. As an old earther, one who believes that the earth is about 4.5 billion years old, sometimes Christians will say to me, could not God, who knows the end from the beginning, have done it all much faster? And I'd say undoubtedly, yes, he certainly could do it much faster than 4.5 billion years. So the question is not what God could do, but what God did do. I'd like to turn the question around and say, could not God, who is perfectly capable of creating the entire universe as we know it in 6 literal solar days, as a demonstration of his great power and wisdom, could he not choose, I'm not saying now he definitely did, but I'm saying could he not choose, if he so desired, to take much longer, and thereby exhibit other of his attributes, in addition to his raw power, if you want to call it that? Could he not have demonstrated over a longer period of time his love of beauty, his creativity, his sense of humor sometimes, his imagination, things that we enjoy doing? I think one of the best analogies I can come up with, and you hate to make too many analogies from us to God, we're certainly arguing from the lesser to the greater here, but I like to say, as a small boy, I remember my first erector set. I lived in Canada. They didn't call them erector sets. They call them Meccano sets, and they're imported from Great Britain. And I remember my first little Meccano set and how thrilled I was. I also remember how thrilled I was on the subsequent Christmas when I got the next supplement, which enlarged my scope, a few more worm gears, a few more pulleys, some bigger girders, and a new book to tell you how to make bigger and better cranes. And each year, the new addition, as you matured in your engineering skills, that would enable you to make still larger things. And I remember what pleasure I derived from that. I never did turn out to be an engineer. I begged and became a botanist at some point. But in those early days, I was learning how a worm gear worked. And once I had mastered that worm gear, I began to use it in new and exciting applications. And I'll never forget the day when I built my first big fit thing with a Meccano Level 7. It was the 6A set that moved mine from 6 to 7. And I built this big 2-car crane. It was a beauty. I don't know why I ever took it apart. I should have just kept it. It was great. I had all the applications of all the gears and pulleys I'd ever learned in it. Is God like us? Is it fair to say that he's had a child learning how to build an erector set? Did he build prokaryotic organisms and tampers around for 1 billion years before he makes the first eukaryotic organism? It almost sounds blasphemous to limit God to some childish behavior. But I would like to say that God has a child's heart. If there's anything I know about God, is he has a child's heart. And that's why Jesus said, let the little children come to me. The kingdom of heaven is such like this. People who have a child's heart are quicker to the kingdom many times than those of us with our so-called adult hearts. So I do believe that God has a child's heart, and I believe it includes a sense of humor, a sense of pleasure in doing a job well, trying things and perhaps setting them aside. And as a paradigm, I would point you to the incarnation. God Almighty became a man, and he really became a man. I mean, he started in the womb, and he went through birth. And having just had a child, I just marvel time and again. Jesus went through this. I just watched my 21-month-old daughter, who's still wearing diapers, but we have the plastic potty set up in the bathroom, and she's definitely got the idea. I take her through the church at night. One of my duties as janitor is to close the church down, and every restroom we go through, potty, potty, she points them all out. She knows what they're for. She likes to run around sometimes without a diaper on, and just today she did it again. She just left a puddle right on the floor, a nice warm puddle. She looks at her feet, she looks at the puddle, and then she starts to cry. She's not quite sure how that happened yet. She's putting it all together. See, most of the time the diaper's catching up. She doesn't get the connection. Jesus went through that at 21 months, made a puddle, got his feet wet, and cried. And his mother picked him up and dried him off and said it was okay, and eventually taught him all those things. It just seems so wrong. We can't bring God down to that level. But I would argue that the scripture is clear in Luke 2:52 that Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. He grew, learning by trial and error, if you will. He chose to allow himself to enter into our human race at that point. I'm not saying this proves the argument, but I'm saying, could he not, in the creation, have enjoyed himself for 4.5 billion years? Can we arbitrarily rule out the possibility of a God who thoroughly enjoyed his creation over a long period of time? I believe he did. I believe the special revelation known as the Bible has a few subtle, well, some of them are pretty clear to me, clues and hints that that is exactly what he did. And I think the natural revelation, God's book of nature, just cries out with overwhelming evidence that that's exactly what he did. He took his time. It took 4.5 billion years for this planet, longer for some other things that he did, as the astronomers can point out, and he enjoyed every minute of it. And it wasn't all for us, great self-centered creatures that we are, who think this creation is primarily our abode, and therefore everything is aimed at us. If it was just for us, I think he would have done it in 6 literal days. He did it for himself. He found enjoyment in his creation. Can you allow for that, that God found pleasure in what he was doing? He had a lot of good laughs. And like any good engineer, there were some things he set aside and said, I'm not going to use that anymore. And a lot of things that were wonderful and somewhat bizarre and some were actually frightening were extinct before he ever made man. He set them aside. He didn't use them. They're in the fossil record. No man ever saw them. I'm persuaded of that. Some pretty neat things, but they're gone. And like any good engineer, he took off-the-shelf technology and used it again. If a mitochondria is really working well with cytochrome C in that first little eukaryote, why shouldn't he use it in squirrels and corn plants and human beings? Why start from scratch? If I had a worm gear setup that worked in this little thing, why not use it in my big crane when I finally got to that? So why shouldn't God use mitochondria all the way through? And I believe it's pretty obvious he did. Okay, let me make some definitions here. Pro and eukaryotic. How many here have heard those terms? You have some idea what we're talking about. Let me see your hands. Pro and eukaryotic. Good, that's a good number of you. Just in case there's some that are shaky. By 1956, biologists realized that cells and the organisms built from those cells were of two basic types. Prokaryotic and eukaryotic are the titles we give to them. Prokaryotic cells are simpler in structure and seem to occur first in the fossil record, and thus are believed by many to be evolutionarily more primitive and earlier. Makes sense? Seems pretty obvious. And if you're going to believe in evolution, that's what you'd say. You'd say they're evolutionarily, obviously came first, and they're more primitive than the eukaryotic cells. Prokaryotes are defined, then, more technically, as organisms composed of one or more cells, each cell which lacks a nuclear membrane separating the DNA from the cytoplasm, and which lack other membrane-bound organelles. You have DNA in a prokaryotic cell that has some genetic blueprint, but it's not wrapped in a nice, cleanly delineated nucleus. There's no nuclear membrane around it. It's just sort of in the what they call the nuclear region or nuclear area, not that well defined. And there's a lack of other membrane-bound organelles, no Golgi apparatus, no vacuoles, no mitochondria, no chloroplasts. A lot of times these prokaryotic cells can do all these things. They might be able to do photosynthesis on a membrane, but they don't have a clean-cut, distinct organelle to do it. And so everything's kind of just in the soup, you might say, loose. The eukaryotes, then, are much more advanced, and the term eukaryote, eu stands for good or true, and karyote for nucleus. So a eukaryotic organism has a good nucleus, or a true nucleus, and has numerous other organelles, such as I mentioned, vacuoles, mitochondria, Golgi bodies, etc. It may sound like a deceptively small difference, but in fact it is no small jump to get from the prokaryotic to the eukaryotic. It is really a vast gulf. True chromosomes that come together during cell division, that undergo mitosis. How many here had enough biology, high school or otherwise, you remember struggling through mitosis? Can I see your hands? Prophase, all that. Metaphase, anaphase, telophase, interphase. Good. You've heard of those terms. You know how complicated it is. A mitotic spindle, the chromosomes line up. And if that isn't bad enough, then you get meiosis, where you go through everything twice, two prophases and metaphases. It really gets complicated. Lots of stuff going on. I saw a recent issue of Scientific American had an article on the mitotic spindle. So much research being done on exactly how this works. Lots to be learned. Mysterious little centrioles that we barely understand what they're doing. To go from a prokaryotic cell to a eukaryotic cell is far larger jump than going from a Conestoga wagon to a Rolls Royce, I would argue. And having said that, I now want to give you an allegory, and I'm going to ask Dr. Newman and Perry if they can help me distribute. They have 30 copies here, which they don't reach you, I have to just share. Don't write on these unless you want them. Here's how I'm going to do. Four-page handout. I'm charging you my cost of 6 cents a page for Xeroxing and a penny profit, 25 cents if you want to keep it. So don't write on until you're sure it's worth keeping, okay? I want to collect those that aren't sold. You'll notice the title on this thing is Paleokaryology as a Useful Paradigm for Appreciating Present Problems in Paleobotany. And I honestly believe it's worth the time it's going to take to plow through this. Somebody said that one picture is worth a thousand words, and I believe one good allegory is worth the rest of my lecture, if this really helps you understand what's happening. And I believe this little allegory of paleocarriageology will exemplify many of the vexing problems in paleobotany. I want you to imagine that you've been taught all your life that automobiles evolved. That sounds a little funny, but that's the way you were brought up. You were brought up, and all your school teachers told you that automobiles evolved. Okay, so you accepted it. Indeed, all forms of carriages and wagons prior to the automobiles are a type of evolution. None of these vehicles were designed or created by any mind or intelligence, but they simply represent a slow and obvious progression from the simple to the more complex. You've never really questioned this model because all the scientific authorities you've ever heard speak about it have affirmed it. So, in that case, what might a sophisticated scientific enterprise such as paleocarriageology offer us? The definitions, by the way, are going to be useful because they're real and they'll carry over into my paleobotany. The first one isn't too helpful, but the others may be helpful. Paleocarriageology is the science that deals with the macroevolution of carriages from ancient times to the present based on fossil remains of the same. Carriage taxonomy, much as plant taxonomy, is the science of naming and classifying carriages, both ancient and modern. And a carriage phylogeny is the theoretical evolutionary history of that particular species. That's true of plants or animals, in this case of carriages. And phylogenetic taxonomists try to classify carriages by their phylogenetic, sometimes shortened to phyletic, relationships. So terms I'll be using later in my lecture, taxonomy, phylogeny, phylogenetic, and phyletic, you want to have some familiarity with. Now, the abstract on this science is, the broad outlines of carriage macroevolution are very clear, and there's wide agreement among paleocarriageologists, especially as regards the taxonomy of carriages proposed by the Royal Automobile Club of Great Britain and the Automobile Club de France. There is less agreement as regards the finer points of carriage phylogeny. Precise phylogenetic details are obscure, and competing phylogenies based on different criteria are often contradictory and result in entirely different schemes. And that is just so true of paleobotany, as you shall see shortly. Perhaps with more time and the discovery of more carriage fossils, these contradictions and ambiguities will be resolved. Recently proposed mechanisms, such as convergent evolution, may help to clarify some apparent discrepancies. For example, it is now widely accepted that the independent, sudden appearance of the phylogenetically advanced electric starter in five or six different classes of phylum Gasolinolophida can only be accounted for by convergent evolution. The selective advantages for these convergent adaptations are, in most cases, obvious. Okay, taxonomy. The taxa, the hierarchical categories of classification proposed by this Royal Club of Britain and Club of France and ratified by the International Committee on Vehicular Nomenclature, are now universally recognized. In this scheme, there are two kingdoms. Kingdom Procarriageota includes all carriages that are heterolocomotes, that is, those which depend on some external source of locomotion, donkeys, mules, oxen, horses, even humans. All of our earliest carriage fossils, Precambrian, are members of this kingdom, as are certain extant forms like the Amish buggies in Lancaster and the Japanese rickshaws, etc. As one would expect, the prokaryotic specimens are comparatively primitive in the entire range of features. Kingdom Eukaryota includes all carriages that are autolocomotes, that is, those which are self-propelled. These more advanced carriages appear later in the fossil record, starting with the so-called Cambrian auto explosion, and ultimately become not only far more sophisticated, but much more numerous and diverse than their prokaryotic counterparts. Phylogeny. It is obvious, notice those words, it is obvious that the eukaryotes have evolved from the prokaryotes. No one questions this fact. The oldest, most primitive eukaryotic autolocomotes look strikingly similar to the prokaryotic heterolocomotes, except for their primitive little engines and drivetrains, which it is agreed must have arisen by some sort of endosymbiotic association of several ancient heterolocomotes. The fossil record clearly reveals a steady progression and proliferation of increasingly complex and sophisticated eukaryotic autolocomotes. Although a fair number of representative prokaryotic heterolocomotes are still extant today, these have not evolved significantly since ancient times. That is, they are strikingly similar to their oldest ancestors. On this much, all carriage taxonomists and paleocarriageologists can agree. What are the major phyla? Now, if any of you are car buffs, my wife saw what I was doing. She said, good grief, you're going to get so excited about old cars, you're not going to listen to plants at all when you do this. I said, well, I have here asterisks, which I say historical notes, and I ran out of time, and you don't have any historical notes. So I'll be honest with you, I'm not an old car buff. All this information is from Encyclopedia Britannica, Volume 1 under Automobiles in the Macropedia, 1975, 10th edition. Go look it up and have a blast. There really were cars that had windmills, and there really were clockwork cars. Even Homer in the Iliad talked about some self-propelled tricycles. Some guy made 20 of them, and he discussed it. So, I mean, people have been dreaming about cars for a long time, folks. It just took a while to get it together. So you see all the phyla I have here. Number D, Steamalopita. 1678, there's some Jesuit in China built a steam car over there. Electrolophida, just a historical note. I got interested in cars the more I pursued this. In 1912, we hit the peak in America. There were 33,000 registered electric automobiles and 20 companies making them. And do you know what finally did them in? The electric starter. When the women didn't have to deal with that crank anymore and the electric starter came in, we were shifted over to gasoline Lophida. In 1 year, the whole thing was declining. So 1912 was the peak of Electrolophida in the fossil record. Gasoline Lophida, the most recent and most phylogenetically advanced of all carriages, dominates the landscape today. Those are the angiosperms, okay? But not until modern times. The landscape at the start of the 20th century was dominated by numerous bizarre species, now extinct of Phyla, Steamalophida, and Electrolophida, whereas species of Gasoline Lophida were in the minority. Now, here comes the fun part. How do we put the phylogenies together? We agree on the broad outline, no problem. We can see the broad picture of macroevolution, but let's try to refine a little bit. Here is a small sampling of the numerous proposals in the paleocarriage literature. A criteria for a phylogeny, how about the number of wheels? It has long been recognized that three-wheeled carriages are typically more primitive than four-wheeled carriages. A lot of the early cars were three-wheeled. For example, the earliest fossil of a steam-powered carriage, Phylum Steamalophida, was a tricycle. Comes from 1769, the Nicholas Joseph Cugnot. Likewise, many early species in Gasoline Lophida, genus Dens, all species from 85 to 90. The problems with that criterion, however, are several. One, there are numerous two-wheeled autolocomotes extant today that are very sophisticated and evolutionarily advanced. Species Harley-Davidson. Numerous others, and family motorcycle ACE. And yet it is generally assumed that the two-wheeled species must be more primitive than either three- or four-wheeled species. To further complicate matters, a vast majority of the markedly primitive heterolocomotes in Kingdom Procarriota are four-wheeled, most of the simple and oldest wagons. Let's try open versus closed carriages. Another general assumption often seen in the literature is that an open carriage with no roof or a few windows is a primitive condition, and that closed carriages represent a major phyletic advance. The problem here is that some members of Kingdom Procarriota, both extinct and extant forms, were or are closed. Covered wagons, royal coaches in several cultures, and some modern carriages are open. Subspecies convertibilis can be found in many, if not most, classes today of Phylum Gasolinolophida, especially family sports car ACE. Now, let's try cylinders. This is a little better. It has been proposed that an increasing number of cylinders would be a useful criterion for working out phyletic relationships within Phylum Gasolinolophida. This view has been greatly strengthened by the discovery of several species in genus Benz, the oldest fossil dating to 1885, fossil genus Lambert, 91, and two closely related in genus Duryea, species Frank and Charles, all of which had one-cylinder gasoline engines. A major problem with this proposal is that the number of cylinders seems to reach a peak in the Mesozoic era of the ultra-large classic luxury cars. It is not uncommon to find V8s and straight 12s in the time frame of 1925 to 1942, when the luxurious fast motor car reached a peak never to be achieved again in carriage history. Well-known species in this prolific category are Rolls-Royce from Great Britain, Hispano Suiza from Spain and France, as well as representative species in the genera Bugatti, Delaghi, I'm not sure I pronounce all these guys right, Delahaye, Hotchkiss, Talbot, Dirac, Boysen of France, Duesenberg, Cadillac, Packard, and Pierce Arrow of the United States, Porsche, Maybach, and Mercedes-Benz of Germany, genus Minerva of Belgium, and Isotta Fraschini of Italy. All of these specimens are believed by scientists to have been very fast, 90 to 130 miles per hour, comfortable, and exquisitely luxurious. Some fossils have been found with upholstery in matched ostrich hide with ivory buttons, dashboards in rosewood, etc. The question of why these marvelous carriages went extinct is still a matter of much debate among paleocarriageologists today, but one widely accepted theory is that a market collapse in 1929 so altered the economic climate that many species of the Mesozoic era simply could not survive. Another problem with the number of cylinders hypothesis is that many of our most modern species, since the Pleistocene of the 1960s, have only four cylinders. This phenomenon of an evolutionary return to smaller engines is worldwide in scope. Well, let's try the carburetor. That has certainly advanced steadily. It doesn't revert back. It has been suggested that a series of gradually more advanced features in the carburetor, clearly preserved in the fossil record, would prove to be the key to unraveling phyletic relationships in phylum Gasolina Lophida. The most primitive carburetor ever described was found in a fossil near Allentown, Pennsylvania, dated to the year 1899. This rare specimen relied on a wooden wick that delivered fuel to the cylinder by capillary attraction. Indeed, many other increasingly complex features can be documented in the fossil remains of carburetors, but these often emerge simultaneously in numerous distinct phyletic lines. The attempt to unravel the phylogeny of this phylum on the basis of carburetor evolution has been frustrated over and over again by parallel developments, a phenomenon known as convergent or parallel evolution. The most recent example in carriage history is the sudden appearance of fuel injection as a replacement for more conventional carburation in numerous independent classes and families of phylum Gasolina Lophida. This amazing evolutionary jump involves the precise metering of fuel for each cylinder and thus provides a means of ensuring the ideal air-fuel ratio is being burned in the engine. It also eliminates cylinder-to-cylinder variations and the tendency of cylinders that are most remote from the carburetor to receive less fuel than as desired. A variety of metering and control systems have evolved with a continuous flow system, first appearing in a fossil from 1957. The selective advantages for all these parallel systems were evidently great enough to produce this striking example of convergent evolution. Or, to word it slightly differently, the selection pressure was great enough to cause different classes and families of gasoline-powered autolocomotes to all evolve in this direction. The last attempt that I give here is the type of starter. Another striking evolutionary advance in the development of autolocomotive fauna is the electric starter. No one questions that the primitive hand crank type of starter at some point must have evolved into the far more sophisticated electrical starter, and yet the origin of this device is obscure. The fossil of Duryea Frank has been dated to 1892 or 3 and clearly shows a one-cylinder gasoline engine with electrical ignition installed in a second-hand carriage. This fossil has caused quite a stir for its obviously endosymbiotic engine on one hand, and yet its totally anomalous occurrence of an electrical starter well before such starters were thought to have evolved. The next fossil evidence for electrical ignition occurs in 1912, after which it rapidly proliferates throughout all classes of the phylum. Similar to the carburetor, the strong selection pressures evidently induced convergent evolution of electric starter in at least five or six major classes initially, so that this feature has not proven to be a useful criterion in establishing a comprehensive phylogeny for the entire phylum. That sounds silly, I know, but that's exactly what you get into when you get into macroevolution, and in my case, paleobotany, is you have a broad outline that everybody can agree on. It's obvious. We go from the simple to the complex. We see the general trend, but get in there and try to fine-tune it. Try to get a phylogeny and get a good criterion on which to base it, and you just get frustrated. You say, well, this is nice. You realize mammals have arisen five times? They honestly believe that mammals occurred five different times. And that's not like plants, that's over in the animals. But this is the kind of thing you're going to run into again and again. And I believe that although there's one major difference between my allegory and what we believe, and that is that God is one engineer instead of, you know, multiplied thousands of human engineers, I think there's a lot that carries over. What the human engineers do, they build on knowledge from the past. And when they see this other guy has a good idea, they borrow it. And God didn't borrow anybody else's ideas, but he had some good ideas that he took off the shelf and used again, like any good engineer. If you got an electric starter, you reapply it. If you have good carburation, you use it again. And we're going to see in photosynthesis some recent advances where God stepped up photosynthesis from the C3 to the C4 pathway. It's a really fairly recent thing. But having done it, he did it all over the place. He didn't just do it in one place. So I believe God is the engineer, and I believe he acts like any wise engineer would, and the record we have reveals that kind of progress. And if you could just accept this simple analogy, I believe it does clear up many vexing questions that we wrestle with in this macroevolutionary model. Okay. One more question may arise in the old Earth model, and that is, if you really give them 4.5 billion years, isn't that enough time for the atheistic and agnostic macroevolutionists to have their way? Isn't that enough time, then, that they can have evolution by random processes and by chance? And I would say, most emphatically, no, it isn't. 400 billion years will not be enough, and I hope that in my talk tonight, and again tomorrow morning, that that will be very, very obvious, that no, it is not enough time, and that is not a matter of concern, should not be a matter of concern to Bible-believing Christians. Finally, we're going to get to the plants. That wasn't too bad, was it? Okay, here they are. Classification of living organisms, traditionally regarded as plants. A lot of arguments sometimes, what is a plant and what isn't, especially with the little one-cell types. But the prokaryotes in Kingdom Monera Certainly, there's a lot of things there that can do photosynthesis. There's quite a few that can do the most modern form of photosynthesis, oxygenic photosynthesis, in which water is split as the final electron acceptor, oxygen is released. So just like our average modern green plant, angiosperm, so some of these little things, the cyanobacteria, can do photosystem 1, photosystem 2, the whole package. Then we move to the eukaryotes, which, as I mentioned, are considerably more advanced. And we have four kingdoms here, and of the plants, three of those four kingdoms involve what might be called plants. Biology is basically five kingdoms today. Most people, I think, would accept a five-kingdom model. Kingdom Monera for all the prokaryotes, and then kingdoms Protista for one-celled eukaryotes, kingdom Fungi for all those things that are called a fungus. They don't do any photosynthesis. They're heterotrophs. They need to get their food elsewhere. All of the plants, kingdom Plantae, and all of the animals, higher animals, kingdom Animalia. Kingdom Animalia does not concern us, but every other kingdom does. Under the Protista, we have many one-celled algae, and you see all the divisions there, Chlorophyta, Phyophyta, Rhodophyta, Chrysophyta, Pyrophyta, Euglenophyta. We even have some heterotrophic protists, little one-celled things that are pretty much like fungi, and they don't do photosynthesis, so they need to turn to others for their food, other sources. Fungi, a whole kingdom of those. Then under kingdom Plantae, we have some major categories to consider. The bryophytes, which are non-vascular land plants, like your mosses, your hornworts, and your liverworts. Plants that have to hug the shore of a brook or some source of water. They can't get too far from water because they don't have any phloem and xylem. And then you have the vascular plants, which do have phloem, xylem, conducting tissues. They can get far removed from water sources. And you have the seedless vascular plants. And then finally, the last development, seed plants. And the most recent development of all is the angiosperms, which are listed here as division Anthophyta. Angiosperms, flowering plants, two classes, dicots and monocots. I have in the past asked somebody to name their favorite plant when I do this talk, and almost invariably, there's always a wise guy that picks some moss or something. But usually people pick roses and begonias or oranges or bananas, something that we're familiar with, and that immediately puts you in the category of angiosperm. The point is that if you tally up all the angiosperms on the face of the earth today, there's six times as many of those as there is everything else put together. So definitely, we are dominated by class angiosperma today, here called phylum Anthophyta. And that's the fruiting plants, flowering. They have flowers and they form fruits, and it's just by far a recent evolutionary development, but a very dominant one at this point in world history. Okay, in your handout, I have setting the parameters. That's what we just did, setting the parameters. We just went over, is there any question on that much? If you look at your handout and what I showed on the overhead, in terms of what's the territory that we're trying to cover when we talk about plant evolution, it's a broad swath of the living biosphere, as we call it in biology, all the living matter on the face of the earth. What I want to do now is, I'm going to show you a few pictures of some of these, and then we're going to scan the fossils and see what's happening. But just a few pictures here of some of these prokaryotes. Kingdom Monera, this first little thing up the corner are the guys that make sour milk, little rod-shaped bacteria. These little necklace-type creatures here are some of our common blue-green algae, which scientists would prefer not to call algae because it gets too confusing. So we prefer, if you would be so kind, is to call them cyanobacteria. If you can't remember that, just say blue-green bacteria. And here is another type of blue-green bacteria, Oscillatoria. So they form these like necklaces. They're really colonies with individual cells. They're not a true multi-celled organism. They're just a chain or a necklace of single-cell types. And here's some artist conceptions of some of these beautiful things. These are some of the first things to show up on the face of the Earth. When the Earth has cooled down, life can conceivably be supported. Maybe 3.5 billion years ago, we find evidence of this type of life before anything else. Here's a nice picture to illustrate our basic distinction between pro- and eukaryotic organisms. This is a freeze etch electromicrograph in a freeze etch. They actually quick freeze a cell with liquid nitrogen, very cold temperatures, things brittle. You can crack it, it breaks open on a fracture line. They can dust some metallic gold or something on here, powder, and then get good resolution. And what is shown here is illustrated by the artist below is the phylloid, which is a photosynthetic membrane, but no chloroplast. A plasma membrane around the whole cell nucleoplasm, which is a vague nuclear area, a food reserve, a cell wall. But that's about it. Pretty simple compared to our eukaryote, which has nice chloroplast, nice mitochondria, Golgi body, chloroplast with a membrane around it, nuclear membrane with nuclear pores on it, endoplasmic reticulum, which is like a countertop for enzymes to hold onto and ribosomes. Much more elaborate equipment going on in the eukaryotic. By the way, do feel free to raise your hand, or I don't see your hand at any point to speak up. If anything I say is unclear, you want me to just back up for a moment. No philosophical questions at the end, but a technical one we'll entertain as we go here. Here's the algae as they're typically broken down. Recently, with the use of the electron microscope, we have moved away from these types of criteria to far more ultra-structural criteria in trying to do both our taxonomy and the phylogeny of the algae. It's been confusing doing it this way, but it's even more confusing when we start using electron microscope and we see if there's one thylakoid membrane, or is there three stacked up three, or is there a whole stack of these things. So, as I mentioned in my little carriageology analogy, I don't care what criteria you use, you begin to get contradictions, you begin to find things coming in several different branches at once. But this has been, up till now, a fairly useful way to break them down. Green, brown, red, golden brown, dinoflagellates, and the little euglenoids. And some of the things that do consistently seem to differ are the pigments that are in them, the type of food reserve they have, how many flagella, what type of flagella, what's the cell wall made of, and a few other things. So at least we have gotten into some broad categories. This is going to be important later as we look at the evolution of these things, because if we make this our basis of phylogeny, then we have some curious things happening. And you do. Now, the other plants, just so you have some familiarity, when I speak of the bryophytes, non-vascular land plants, no vascular tissue, no true roots, stems, or leaves. You do have something called rhizoids that anchor the plant and absorb a little water, but not too much, not more than a few centimeters tall as a result of that. And the sporophyte, well, let's skip that more technical material. Under the tracheophytes, which are the vascular plants, the type we're mostly familiar with, you do have phloem and xylem, vascular tissue. Most modern forms have roots, stems, and leaves, and they're usually more than a few centimeters high. And they're very self-sufficient, independent sort of plants, and they're usually photosynthetic, obviously. Down below, the lower vascular plants, you see there's several classes. What's interesting about these classes is that today we have relatively few representative species. There is times in the past where these things dominated the landscape. Even as the angiosperms do today, there was a time when the seed ferns, the club mosses, reached gigantic proportions. They were bizarre-looking things, and very large and very numerous, and they're buried in our fossil record. So class like Hopsida, ferns, and our Spinopsida, horsetails, and our Phyllocopsida. All of these being things that today are much more limited in number of species and smaller, by far smaller than they were. Now we're going to move to scanning the fossil record, part two of your handout. What has a century of paleobotany told us about the appearance of these four kingdoms over time? This particular world map helps you to see where we have major outcroppings of Precambrian rock. And where we have these, this is where we're beginning to find, or for the last 20 or 30 years have been finding, microfossils of blue-green algae, other bacteria, the earliest eukaryotic organisms. Gunflint formation at Lake Ontario is an important one. You may have heard about some of these. The fig tree down in South Africa, Bitter Springs, the North Pole in Australia. Some very important sites where we are consistently finding what people thought was rock devoid of fossils. Precambrian rock had often been thought to have no fossils, and fossils of living organisms showed up in Cambrian material, called the Cambrian explosion, as I had the Cambrian auto explosion in that allegory. But now we're finding, no, there's quite a lot of fossils in Precambrian material, at least late Precambrian, and it's small, and it's chiefly prokaryotic. Boy, it gives you the creeps. You say, man, if that's true, then maybe evolution happened, right? I mean, there's all the simple stuff at the beginning. The oldest rocks have the littlest things and the simplest stuff. Maybe we're wrong. Maybe this all evolved. Or maybe our engineers started small and worked up. That's what we want to try to think about as we proceed. Interestingly enough, the evidence for the blue-green bacteria, the cyanobacteria, the best evidence for them being very, very old is an indirect type of evidence. Yes, we have found some fossils of the actual organisms, often in a type of amber, a rock that has a lot of silica in it that hardens beautifully and we can see them. But that goes back to maybe 2 billion years. 3.5 billion years ago, we're finding excellent fossil remains, not of the actual organisms, but of the structures that they built called stromatolites. And here is a picture of an Archean stromatolite. The word stromatolite has a restricted meaning. It is applied to organosedimentary structures, predominantly accreted by sediments that have precipitated as a result of the growth and metabolic activities of prokaryotic microorganisms on the ocean floor. This particular one here, that you can see a man standing there. See the little man out with the rocks there? He's walking over these stromatolites. This formation is actually only 900 million years old in North Greenland. But we have found others that are about 3.5 billion years old. Scientists can see these today. There are stromatolites that are even now being formed as these organisms each year lay down a layer. The algae grow in a mat. The mat traps this fine-grained carbonate sediment, calcium carbonate, etc. Eventually, after many layers, sort of like the annual rings of a tree building up, after many layers are laid down, silica material can come in and harden this and preserve it, and we have these mounds that can be looked at later and date them and get an idea that this is very, very old material, and there must have been the same kind of formations that we're seeing form today. It's a pretty good argument that the blue green algae were one of the first things on the Earth, as I mentioned earlier. Any questions on scanning the fossils up to that point? I don't have any overheads for the remainder of your handout, so let's just look at the handout real quickly here. The Paleozoic era, everything I looked at there on the overheads is Precambrian, up to about 0.6 billion years ago. We have lots of evidence of Kingdom Monera and just a little bit of the introduction of Protista, the eukaryotes, maybe some early fungi. But the Paleozoic era now, and in particular the Cambrian period, we have an explosion, including many, many diverse forms of eukaryotes, Kingdom Protista. The Ordovician period is not too significant for plant evolution. There is one gentleman named Gray, and he's listed in your bibliography at the back. If you look at the back under J. Gray, 1985, he believes, from microspore formations, that we may have some early phases of terrestrial plant life going all the way back to the late Ordovician. Most people would say the later Silurian period for vascular plants, land plants. No question about the Devonian period, however. The vascular plants take off like a bomb in the Devonian period and just diversify tremendously. And especially those classes that are not so common today, as I mentioned, horsetails, club mosses, and ferns. The Carboniferous period, we have club mosses, ferns, not too much of a change. Many bizarre forms going extinct, though, at the end of that time. In the Permian period, there's a major time of extinctions. The Mesozoic era, this is our time of the great dinosaurs. We also have some interesting plants, whole forests of large gymnosperms. We have angiosperms coming in at the end of the Mesozoic era, where it says Cretaceous period, 135 to 65 million years ago. Angiosperms originate, spread, gymnosperms decline, another major period of extinctions. And then angiosperms are what continue into the present era, the Cenozoic era. Many monocots, grasses initially, and then into our modern period, extinction again of many species. Rise of herbaceous plants, many desert forms, pretty much what we have in our world today. How do we put it together? How does your average macroevolutionist or paleobotanist try to put this all together? Well, he's persuaded of one thing, and that is everything is linked to some common ancestor. I mean, that's a given. And so you have to work from that premise. This is a typical little family tree of the plant world, if you will. Everybody likes to start with an ancestral green algae. There's reasons for that. But in a nutshell, the pigments and the type of photosynthesis that's conducted in these green algae is just closer. So structurally and biochemically, we're closer to our modern green plants than we are in the red algae, the brown algae, and all the other algae we looked at. So almost all paleobotanists can agree, this is obvious now, this is one of our obvious links, that we're going to get the higher plants of all types from an ancestral green algae. All the way up here to our modern green algae, but coming off the sides are the bryophytes, non-vascular mosses, and liverworts, the vascular ferns, primitive gymnosperms giving rise both to modern gymnosperms and angiosperms, the monocots and the dicots being the modern angiosperms. So yeah, everything ties together real nicely. a slightly more honest diagram here. More honest because it has question marks in it. It comes from another introductory textbook. Starting with the earliest cells. A lot of interest right now, something called Prochlorion, a very large green bacteria that for a while people thought was obvious gave rise to higher chloroplasts. And now, in a recent issue, was pointed out to be in Nature. They're saying it's not all that obvious. They think it's convergent evolution. This thing moved toward phylloid membranes like a modern chloroplast, but that's probably independent of higher plants. But at any rate, coming up the line, notice these dead ends, Gorgonophyta, red algae. There's a dead end branch, a separate line of evolution. Pliophyta comes off, brown algae. The only thing that they honestly believe led to land plants is the chlorophyta, the green algae. So again, that much we're agreed on. Over here, where we take a closer look at the phylogeny, we start to have a few problems. There's some debate which class of the chlorophyta. One of the arguments is a group called Charophyta. But notice the dotted line. It's not at all obvious how we get from these algae to the Tracheophyta, which appear in the fossil record, complete with phloem and xylem. And suddenly we have tracheids, we have sieve tooth numbers, we have sieve plates, we have xylem vessels. We have, in vascular plants, a whole package. You have to have a cuticle, a waxy layer in the leaf. You have to have stomates that can permit gases in and out. They're controlled by guard cells. You have an elaborate system in a vascular plant. It's no small jump. And it's quite a shaky thing to get from even Charophyta over to Tracheophyta. So at least they're having a dotted line. Now, any good macroevolutionist would say, but it's obvious that the non-vascular land plants would have come first, the bryophytes. They didn't have phloem and xylem, but they had these simple rhizoids. So wouldn't you evolve from a green algae to a bryophyte, and then from a bryophyte get to a tracheophyte? That seems obvious. The fossil record very strongly says no. And so they're compelled to make a separate branch over here for the bryophytes. And what's really vexing is that our earliest fossils are tracheophytes. We have earlier represented as the vascular plants, the bryophytes are the Johnny come lately on the scene. Why would anybody make bryophytes after tracheophytes? You know, after you successfully make really good land plants, what are you going to go back and make bryophytes for? I think occasionally with my erector set, I went back and built some simple stuff after I made some complicated stuff. Is there anything wrong with doing that? If there's somebody doing it. But if it's happening by evolution, it's very vexing to have the tracheophytes come in before the bryophytes. But they do admit and must illustrate that that's the case. Then the tracheophytes mushroom all over the place. I guess the most important thing to notice is the big question mark of angiosperms. A very hotly debated point among all paleophylogenists is how do we get to those angiosperms? What do you link them up to? It's not at all clear or obvious how we got to the flowering plant. It's obvious that they're now dominant. It's obvious that in the Cretaceous period, they just appeared on the scene in full bloom, literally. Petals, sepals, stamens, pistils, fruit, ovaries, pollen, stigma, mechanisms of pollination, they're there. And how we get there is a very serious question. It produces a lot of interesting scientific literature. If you'd like to read paleobotany, people are doing circuit length. This is an illustration of the kinds of problems you run into where you invoke convergent evolution. And throughout this lecture, I'll be referring to this parallel evolution convergent. It just has to be invoked. Zostera phyllophyta and Rhynchophyta are two radically different kinds of vascular plants. And without getting into all the gory details of why they differ and how they differ, it involves, for those of you who want to know, whether the xylem forms centripetally or centrifugally, which way the xylem matures and develops, and a few other very technical things about branching of the plants. Scientists are compelled, simply compelled by the fossil record, to say that the vascular plants have arisen more than once. They must have, because these things are just too different to be related. And yet they both appear roughly at the same time. I believe the Zostera phyllophyta come a little bit earlier. And many scientists would make three. They would take the Trimeropoda and make that not a descendant of the Rhynchophyta, but a separate. So it's either two or three. Everybody agrees that at least twice vascular plants have arisen, and probably three times, complete with the same package of features. The cuticle in the leaves, the waxy layer to keep the moisture in, the stomates, the guard cells, the xylem, the phloem. The entire package of options that come with vascular plants at least twice has arisen in the same stuff. Couldn't you think of another way to make a waxy layer? You know, this is what always interests me. If you're going to design a plant that, yeah, the leaf has to have a waxy layer, does it have to be cutin? Making the cuticle, couldn't it be suberin? seed ferns. Ferns that have true seeds are a thing of the past. We have nothing like them today. We have plenty of flowering plants today. But all sorts of neat experiments, I believe, that the Lord did, are left behind. Okay, let's see where we are in the handout at this point. We have pretty much looked at what the fossil record has to tell us. We looked at some putative scenarios, how they try to put it together. No problem with the big picture, lots of problems when we try to fine-tune the small picture. I want to zero in the time remaining on some major problems. And in your handout, it says for all macroevolutionary schemes, some major problems are 1, origin of eukaryotes, 2, origin of angiosperms, 3, this frequent invoking of convergent evolution. I'm going to add a few, so if you're taking notes, the first one I want to consider is not the eukaryotes. I want to consider origin of photosynthesis. So the first thing we want to look at is a major problem in plant evolution is the origin of photosynthesis. Then we want to consider the eukaryotes, which is listed there. But after eukaryotes, I want to consider vascular plants, origin of vascular plants, then the origin of true seeds, then the angiosperms, and then we'll pick it up from there. So I'm adding a few topics that aren't on your handout. I'm feeling a little luxurious tonight, like I have enough time to do this all done. Photosynthesis, a very favorite topic of mine. Perhaps one of the reasons I became a botanist. The biggest push, there's several big pushes in my life that turned me into a botanist and a plant pathologist. One was all my mother's houseplants. Never underestimate, women, what you're doing to your children. My mother had houseplants in every room, every windowsill. Half her life was consumed in watering them, and half our sorrow was finding half of them dead after vacation when you leave them too long and come back. And I used to do demography. I used to count them. I knew how many she had. I had, you know, all of them numbered. I was really interested in them. I didn't realize how interested I was until I went off to college. I knew I wanted to major in biology. One semester of zoology clinched it for me. I said, I'm a botanist. And I've been looking at plants ever since. And then I got very fascinated by viruses and are they dead or alive, and that just put me into plant pathology. The only way you're allowed to be a botanist who's interested in viruses is if you study viruses that make plants sick. So that got me into plant pathology, and that's where I've been ever since. Photosynthesis, though, has always intrigued me. I think it intrigues a lot of scientists because it is how energy gets into our world. You know, think about it. You're sitting here tonight, you're alive because of energy. You couldn't be here if you didn't have energy to keep your heart beating and move the pen and all those good things. That ultimately goes to the sun. All the energy for all that we do and all that the animals do and all that the plants do, everything can be traced back to the sun with a few rare exceptions, with a few crazy little bacteria. The Lord just, again, his sense of humor is great. He says, I'm not going to make everything photosynthetic or photosynthetic dependent. You have a few bacteria over here that can do it another way, chemosynthetic bacteria that can do something a little different. But everything that you and I are eating, we're not eating chemosynthetic bacteria out here. We're eating food that is either photosynthetic or it in turn ate something photosynthetic, and that's where all our nutrition is coming from. So the energy flow into this whole biosphere, the whole world in which we live, comes through photosynthesis. It is the gateway that permits life, biological life, to continue. That has to be fascinating just for that reason, that it's so important to all forms of life. I think I also found it interesting, though, just because I remember doing a science fair project in high school, and I did some aspect of photosynthesis, and I got a prize, and there's no better way to encourage a future scientist to give them a prize for something. That really got me interested in it. But I got very interested when I went to Cornell University, majoring in plant pathology, and found out they had a whole department of plant physiology at Cornell where some of these guys are doing nothing but studying photosynthesis. You know, I started at the University of Maine as a little lowly undergrad, and the plant physiologists were across the hall. I get to Cornell, and they're across the mall, and the whole building with these guys, and they're doing all this research. And you go over, and here's Dr. Andre Jagendorf, who's one of the world's renowned plant physiologists. And I realize this guy spends his whole life looking, and you'll see this tomorrow in my talk, if you're taking a closer look at a chloroplast, he spends his whole life with an electron microscope looking at a thylakoid membrane in spinach chloroplast, understanding what's called a proton pump during chemiosmosis, one incredibly tiny facet of photosynthesis. I mean, one infinitesimal fraction of what's known about photosynthesis. This man's life is devoted to it. He's making major breakthroughs, and he's training graduate students to go out and make some more breakthroughs. I just say, wow. In 1945, a man named Urbanowicz began to write a three-volume treatise on photosynthesis. He said, I will compile all that we know about this subject. He finished in 1956. 3 volumes later, he was already out of date and had hit the test. But at least they say it's the last time that any one man could possibly know all that we have learned about photosynthesis, because from that time onward, knowledge has just exploded so rapidly that no one person can stay on top of it. So if one of your offspring decides that they're going to be a botanist, and more particularly a plant physiologist, and more specifically a photosynthesis person the rest of their life, say, sorry, that's too broad. What aspect of photosynthesis do you want to devote the rest of your life to? Do you, like Dr. Dickendorf, want to do chemiosmosis with a proton pump inside the thylakoid membrane? That you may do. And that will consume you for the rest of your life. And that'll probably subdivide a few times, too, before you're finished. Do you realize what we're talking about here? We're talking about knowledge and wisdom that men can glean from the Lord's creation that is infinite, simply infinite. There's just so much to learn. I feel it just has to be said it's infinite because you can just probe deeper and deeper and deeper and further and wider, and there's just so much. You have become so specialized. I look at that and I say, wow. Photosynthesis, by the way, is also one of the more tacky subjects I have to teach at Pine Grove Junior College in an introductory biology course. I always say to the students, we start kind of easy and we build up and we build up, and by middle of the semester, we have a chapter on cellular restoration and then one on photosynthesis. I say, that's the pit. I mean, that's the hardest stuff. That's the most biochemistry. That's the most bizarre stuff. And if you can get past that, it starts downhill again. It's like climb the mountain and it starts sliding a little bit down. You've got to get past photosynthesis and cellular respiration. So they all grit their teeth and they get through this difficult chapter. And it's true. And yet they are scratching the surface in the most introductory fashion. And yet it is horrifyingly complex, the subject of photosynthesis. This photosynthesis, which you'll see in a little more detail tomorrow, with photosystem 1 and photosystem 2 and all this stuff going on, occurs as soon as the Earth is cool enough to allow life. A hot, molten Earth, and I'm buying into the usual model of what scientists believe happened, the geologists, and what they tell us is that 4.5 billion years ago the Earth was formed, but it was red hot, and maybe 1 billion years later, like 3.5 billion years ago, it's cooled down enough that we can conceivably have life. And what do we find in the fossil record? Little blue-green algae, which we prefer to call cyanobacteria, little prokaryotes, and they're doing all of this photosynthesis that we study endlessly with many good minds cranking out journal articles. Incidentally, go into any major university library and ask the librarian to take you to the plant physiology section. If you're at a library where a school has a plant physiology department, just scan the journals. Photosynthetica from Denmark, Plant Physiology from America, and many plant physiology journals from America and Canada and the Soviet Union, some of which are simply called photosynthesis, or photosynthetica, or this and that about proceeding to photosynthesis, the annals of photosynthesis. Journals, every week and every month, coming through the library shelves, dedicated to this subject. The volume of knowledge is like a Niagara Falls. It just keeps rushing and rushing, which is why you can only read your tiny aspect of it. That says an awful lot to me. But there's so much to be known, and it happened 3.5 billion years ago. Why do I say that an old Earth is no threat to the Christians, that you can give them that much time? Because in their own model, they've painted themselves into a corner. In their own model, this most elaborate system is up and running right from the beginning. About as soon as you can support it, it's there, complete, doing its thing. Splitting water, releasing oxygen, drawing electrons, setting up the proton pump, chemiosmosis, ATP synthesis, everything's up and running. Very, 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 very complex. Okay, that's one very serious question that any paleobotanist, I think, must wrestle with if he's going to honestly hold to a macroevolutionary model of the evolution of plants. The next one, origin of eukaryotes, I've already mentioned is a huge jump in complexity. The typical solution right now is to argue endosymbiosis, endosymbionts. That means somebody crawls inside of somebody else, and I'm not poo-pooing that. I don't think it's totally ridiculous. I think we have some living examples of that happening. Occasionally, a little bacteria would crawl inside. The prochlorion bacteria lives inside another little organism. And I have it on my overheads here. There is a picture of a little bacteria that crawled inside something else, took up residence. We certainly have symbiosis in the lichen. We've got algae and fungi living together. The algae produce the food, they do the photosynthesis. The lichen gives the physical support, and together they do extremely well and are successful in some very difficult regions of the Earth to live, on the rocks and the cold climates. Here's the picture I'm looking for. So yeah, I'm not arguing against endosymbiosis and the possibility, in this case, of a cyanobacteria, blue-green bacteria, taking up residence in a somewhat larger cell. The figure caption here says the protist cyanophora with a symbiotic cyanobacteria in its cytoplasm. The cyanobacteria produces food for itself and its host. Cyan Ochre uses its flagellum to move to areas where light is available for the photosynthesis of its symbiont. So one guy's got the whip, the flagellum will swim around, the other guy's got the food. Notice the many layers of photosynthetic membrane in the cyanobacterial cell. He's loaded with those kind of membranes you need to do all this complex work. The argument, however, is that the first chloroplast in a eukaryotic organism was something like this. It crawled inside, took up residence, eventually lost its independence. As the cell reproduced, this little thing reproduced too, so you can keep having offspring. Not a totally far-fetched idea, but you suddenly realize a eukaryote is a whole lot more than that. A eukaryote, as I mentioned earlier, has mitochondria. It has a true nucleus. It goes through mitosis and meiosis. It often has a flagellum, which are far more complex than prokaryotic flagella. Much more complicated internal structure going on with microtubules and whatnot. Well, the answer that's being given right now is, well, we had a series of endosymbiotic events. We had another one crawl in that became the mitochondria. And there's another one crawled in that became these flagella in some fashion. You just keep piling up endosymbiotic explanations. Not all scientists are moving this way. This is the more extreme end of the endosymbiotic spectrum. But it's perhaps the most plausible, because the other side doesn't really have anything too plausible to explain. How do we get from prokaryotes to eukaryotes? It is a huge jump. And I think that probably the best answer you could give from that viewpoint is different things crawled in. But believe me, it's going to take a lot to explain the nucleus. With its nuclear membrane, contiguous to the endoplasmic reticulum, with all its little ribosomes being made inside in the nucleolus, and the incredible dance of the chromosomes, the elaborate movement of chromosomes through a metaphase spindle, mitotic spindle, breaking apart, moving to their opposite poles. It is such a beautiful, orchestrated symphony sort of thing, mitosis. If you've ever watched under a microscope, seen the phases of it, I don't know how any endosymbiotic theory is ever going to explain it, quite frankly. We have nothing like it in the prokaryotes. And I don't know who crawled inside and figured it out. It's incredible. It really is. It's amazing. That jump. And that's not just a botanical problem. That's true of all life. We have to wrestle with this prokaryote to eukaryote. Let me look at the origin of vascular plants for a moment. I've already mentioned the complex package of things that's required. And I've mentioned the several times that it's apparently happened. Matter of fact, that's all I'm going to say about it. I'm going to move on. Let me just refresh you that vascular plants must have arisen at least twice, maybe three times, and with it, this complex package. Let's look at true seeds for a moment. What are we talking about when we talk about a true seed? And then, did that happen just once, or did that happen more than once? I want to read you a quote from an introductory botany book about the seed. Two books, as a matter of fact. I took two quotes. Strictly secular textbook. One, I think, was introductory botany. The other was introductory biology. What are we talking about when we talk about a seed with a seed coat? We're saying this. This is a quote from the botany book. The seed constitutes one of the most dramatic innovations to arise during the evolution of vascular plants, and it seems to be one of the factors responsible for the dominance of seed plants in today's flora. The reason is simple. The seed has survival value. It's very true. Why do seed plants dominate the earth? Which include, incidentally, gymnosperms as well as angiosperms. The pine tree, which doesn't have a fruit, doesn't have flowers in the typical sense, but it does have a true seed. A lot of people fail to realize that. In those pine cones are naked seeds, we call them, but they are a true seed. They have a seed coat. They're simply called naked because they don't have any fruit. No peaches or whatever inside a pine cone. No berries. But it is a true seed. So gymnosperms and angiosperms have this incredible survival value, and as this book correctly says, one of the most dramatic innovations to arise during the evolution of vascular plants. The other biology book said, quote, instead of the single haploid cell of a spore, seeds contain many cells organized into three main parts, the outer protective seed coat, the multicellular diploid embryo of a new sporophyte generation, and a food supply that the new plant uses while its roots and leaves develop from their embryonic rudiments. The seed is an extraordinary evolutionary invention for the survival and perpetuation of terrestrial plants. I would say, yeah, that's right. The seed is an extraordinary. The seed is like the electric starter. It honestly is. To jump from a little spore in some fern or moss to a true seed is just as big a jump as this old hand crank we looked at and the electric starter. It's an amazingly complex little feature. Okay. The other thing I wanted to consider is the... Oh, before I leave that, did it happen only once? I mean, it's pretty remarkable to get from a hand crank to an electric starter. It's very remarkable to get from the spore to the seed. The question is, how many times did it happen? Six times. And the reason I say that is, as we trace back, there are
thing called progenosperms, followed by trigenosperms. And scientists clearly believe that it happened six different times, that we moved from the progenosperms to the trigenosperms on six separate occasions. And that involves the evolution of the tree seed. Each time we do that, we have to have the tree seed. So the tree seed, which I have just read to you from the books, is an extraordinary evolutionary invention with its endosperm and all its features, has to happen six times. This may give a little clue what's going on. Progenosperms had no true seeds. Seed ferns had true seeds. And what they call other gymnosperms. Even that doesn't break it down, but there's about five classes, several of which are extinct, and a number of which are still with us today, all of which do the true seed. Origin of angiosperms. Let me just read you a couple of quotes about that. This is the one I told you is so hotly debated with all the flowers and fruits. Angiosperm information. What a major jump that is. Okay, I don't have any quote that I thought I had on angiosperms. So just from my own memory, to explain to you, angiosperms require another incredible jump in terms of pollination mechanisms. Not only do you have a structurally elaborate system, you've all looked at an Easter lily, right, and looked down and named some of those things inside there, the nice big stigma with its sticky surface, all the beautiful yellow things that we call the stamens, they have anthers and pollen, and how these things, insects, come and cross-pollinate. The pollen germinates, sends down a pollen tube, goes down, style, reaches an ovule, fertilizes a little egg down there, ovum, and that becomes a new seed. And the seeds often form some kind of fruit around them. That's a very simplified explanation of a very complex process. That has to come with angiosperm, that whole mechanism. And with it, many pollination mechanisms with wind and insects that are very clever, that involve mechanisms to get this pollination done. All of this, including the fruits, the flowers, the petals, arises very suddenly in the fossil record. And I forget on that one just how many times. I'm not sure they're even clear how many times. There's so much confusion in angiosperm phylogeny. I'm not sure we're even clear how many times to say it had to happen. But I'm quite sure we can safely say it happened more than once to fit the different phylogenetic lines we're dealing with. Now, I want to do one last thing before I open for questions, and that is what's called the Hatch-Slack pathway of photosynthesis. This is the fuel injection of the paleobotanical system. Just as fuel injection is one of the most recent things in my paleocaryology, and it came through all the various classes of cars, so what's called the Hatch-Slack pathway of photosynthesis is a very recent development. Discovered in the early 60s by two men from Australia, Hatch and Slack. Everybody has named the Hatch-Slack photosynthetic pathway, otherwise known as the C4 pathway. C3 stands for a three-carbon sugar. C4 is an abbreviation for a four-carbon sugar. What we're saying is that in this particular photosynthetic pathway, which is considerably more advanced, we have a four-carbon sugar instead of a three-carbon sugar, the fixation mechanism. Here is a contrast of the two. Arrangement of cells in a C3 leaf. First major difference we're going to have is an anatomical difference. The way the spongy mesophyll cells, the bundle sheath cells, the palisade cells are set up is considerably simpler than a C3 leaf. A C4 leaf, evolutionarily more advanced, has a wreath of bundle sheath cells. It's rather large, quite thick, and it's called the Krantz anatomy. Notice these palisade mesophyll cells, which are here only on the top layer, also form sort of a wreath around it. And then you have our spongy mesophyll. It is a major anatomical difference, and it's consistent. When you find a C4 plant, you have this mechanism, and there's a reason for it. Because the bundle sheath cell and mesophyll cell, the C4 plant, are working in tandem. They're working together to grab on the carbon dioxide at low concentrations and concentrate it. You say, well, what's the importance of that? Have you ever heard people say on a real hot summer day, this is good corn-growing weather? That's true. And the reason it's good corn-growing weather and it's lousy tomato-growing weather is because on a very hot day, a plant, a vascular plant, is compelled to close its stomates down, its stomata. Little openings that normally allow carbon dioxide to come in must be greatly reduced, closed, or all the water vapor gets out. The plant wilts. So to preserve itself on a very hot, sunny afternoon, many plants shut down the stomates and photosynthesis slows way down. The corn plants also close their stomates considerably, but even with that little crack, which only a little CO2 can now get in, they have this mechanism running, which is called the C4 pump, involving the four-carbon sugar and all the complex biochemistry, that can pump the concentration higher, the CO2, in the bundle sheath cell, where the normal C3 photosynthesis takes over. It's called the Calvin cycle,
and we make glucose and various sugars from CO2. It is a very clever mechanism, and if you want to illustrate just how clever it is, you take a bell jar, and you have a flower pot, and in the swirl of the flower pot, you have a wheat seedling and a corn seedling side by side, and you lower a glass bell jar over these two, give them ample water, sunlight, everything they need to grow, and in a matter of a week, the wheat plant is dead, and the corn plant's doing just fine. Why? Because there's limited carbon dioxide in your bell jar. You've got an airtight jar. The wheat plant and corn plant initially are both doing photosynthesis, but as the available CO2 drops, and they're giving off oxygen, by the way, as they photosynthesize, the available CO2 is diminishing. The corn plant, with this clever little mechanism, keeps sucking it up. The wheat plant moves into the survival mode. It begins undergoing respiration to hang in there. That means it's giving off CO2. It's burning up its reserves. And the corn plant simply says, thanks, buddy, and takes in that CO2, too. And eventually, your wheat plant just expires. The corn plant lives. And scientists, when this was discovered, they said, this is important. This is a key feature. If we can get this C4 pathway into soybeans, for example, we can feed all the hungry people in the world. Very altruistic motivation. That's good. They're right. If we could get this more efficient photosynthetic pathway, not only into sugar cane and corn, where it was originally found, but into some of our major C3 food crops, we can feed the world's hungry. We can grow soybeans, bigger bumper crops. That would be fantastic. Now, here's where your belief in macroevolution, and in particular convergent evolution, gets expensive. You put your money where your mouth is, as they say. Scientists at Urbana, Illinois, University of Illinois, said, you know, the more we have studied in the last 10 to 15 years, we're now talking the early 1970s, in the last decade, as they examined the C4 pathway, much to their amazement, they found that it was occurring in many botanical families. It was a cross-section of the botanical flora. Not that all genera and species had it, but every family, just about every botanical family, seemed to have a representative genus or species that had this pathway. It was not limited to grasses like we originally thought, corn, sugar cane, and a few others. It was considerably widespread. And they said, what a classic example of convergent evolution, where selection pressure has caused the same thing to evolve time and time again, probably from 30 to 50 times, we had the C4 pathway evolving. If it's that easy to do, if Mother Nature did it 50 times, surely we can do it. And here's what we'll do. We will grow soybean plants, thousands of them, in flats in the greenhouse. And we will give the selection pressure. I mean, this is how it works, right? Selection pressure is what drives convergent evolution. We will artificially set up selection pressure. What does that mean? That means you grow the soybeans in an atmosphere that doesn't have enough CO2 in it for the average C3 plant. Any good old C3 plant's going to die, but a C4 plant will live. Now, we will irradiate these soybeans with ultraviolet light and other mutagenic agents that jiggle their genes, that knock their DNA around a little bit, and we'll do just what Mother Nature obviously did in almost every botanical family on the face of the earth. We'll knock those genes until it gets the C4 pathway. That's how it must have happened, convergent evolution. It was a brilliant experiment. It is an honest experiment. It is a true scientific experiment. It's exactly what scientists do. It also worked like an experiment should work. It said, no, you're wrong. Because 2 years later, after thousands and thousands of flats of soybeans and all kinds of irradiation and testing, and as I like to jokingly say, millions of soybeans out to the dumpster, all they had was dead soybeans. They didn't get one. Not one. See, the theory would be if you would accidentally irradiate a soybean just the right way to get the C4 pathway, this thing would live. You carry out your flat one day, here's 1,000 little soybean seedlings. Most of them died for lack of CO2, but there's that one guy who's still living. Why is he still living? Because you jiggled his genes and you gave him the C4 pathway. It never happened. It's a little bit like taking your wristwatch when it's not running, going upstairs and throwing it out in the parking lot. It might fix it. Your wristwatch broke, you toss it out in the parking lot, that might do it. There's always that chance. Those gears, especially the old watches that had gears on, these crazy battery-powered ones, it's hard to know what to do with them. But the old watches I can remember as a kid, they took apart and you never could get back together again. Those are the kind you throw out in the parking lot when they stop working. And there's always a chance that those gears will pop together and the thing will start running again. And that's what they were doing. And it cost thousands of dollars and innumerable man hours of work. And the answer was, that's probably not the way the C4 pathway came around. At least they couldn't repeat it. I don't think they gave up on their underlying premise, their theory of plant evolution. But they couldn't do it. I don't think that's how it was done the first time. I don't think that's how it was done the 50 times or more that it probably has happened. There's an engineer. The engineer said, I'll put C4 here, and I'll put C4 here, and I'll put C4 here, and then I'm going to laugh when I watch these jerks try to do it with the soybeans.